destined for you. Gifts from listeners who value and rely on this programming make it all possible. Please make your first time or renewing sustaining gift of $5, $10, or $20 a month right now. Call 713-526-5738. That's 713-JAM-KPFT, or go online to kpft.org today.
The hypnotic beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals it is once again 8 p.m. on Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? We are proud to be the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 Houston. I'm your host tonight, Greg Audell, and alongside what I truly consider the best team on radio, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, our wonderful guest hosts who sit in and spell us from time to time, our engineer extraordinaire, Tatiana Gago, who makes sure that you can hear us crisply and clearly while making sure you don't hear our coughs or our hiccups or any other offensive noises. And, of course, Floyd the Wonder Dog is in the studio roaming the halls with us. So What's Your Story has been celebrating the power of story for almost 12 years now by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on astounding, riveting, challenging, and almost always fascinating journeys before returning us safely and usually gently to the present, all within a very few minutes. That's the beauty of storytelling, my friends. It is the cheapest round-trip ticket in the entire world, yet it can take you absolutely anywhere with no advance reservations required. There is simply no better bargain to be found. If you like what we're doing during this hour, please pick up the phone and call 713-523-5738. And one of our eager volunteers will be glad to take your most generous donation. And you might even get lucky and speak with the illustrious producer and founder of our program, Dr. Hank Rubicek, who will be joining us throughout the program.
And who's about to tell you that it's 526-5738.
Oh, thank you.
KPFT. That's all right. We're all tired tonight, Greg. Don't worry about it, man.
I don't know where I got 523 from. I can always count on Hank to...
It's one of your girlfriend's numbers. I don't know.
Shh!
Many of them.
So, Hank, and is there anything you'd like to say while we've got you on air about
tonight? No. We're going to get started with these wonderful tellers tonight, Greg. We got some very special guests this evening who are going to tell some pretty astounding stories, and then I'm going to feed our audience with a little bit of a background about this show, and hopefully we'll get a few calls in just a little while.
And yes, tonight we will be focusing on a subject that is close to my heart, we'll be talking about a complicated, colorful, and multifaceted Texas politician. When studying those who shaped our nation, we tend to focus our energies on former presidents. And while they're certainly important, a president would be completely irrelevant without skilled players in the House or Senate to help them advance their agendas or to defeat agendas that need to be defeated. My guests tonight are a talented father and son team who have written the most comprehensive book to date about the late congressman from Beaumont, Jack Brooks, who during his 42 years in Congress rose to become the uber-powerful chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. Tim McNulty is a former White House correspondent and a war correspondent, isn't that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And former public editor of the Chicago Tribune. And have you been a lecturer at Northwestern University for 14 years?
10 years, actually.
10 years. I don't know how you found time to do all these things and write a book as well.
Well, that's the trick.
His son, Brendan McNulty, who's with us, is a former crime reporter for the Chicago Tribune, turned consultant in legal and energy industries, And he's been in international development in D.C. for the last 10 years. And yes, he is Tim's son. This is his first book, but he's written for magazines, news services, and journals for over 20 years. And I got to ask you, how different was it doing a book?
A book was, it was like night and day, because the timing is different. The, you know, the arc of the storytelling is different. And it's long. You don't have much feedback for chapter after chapter. And then you kind of submit what you have, and that's the first time you really figure out if it's working or not. So,
well, I want to welcome you both to So What's Your Story, and thank you for flying in just to do this show. That is a real honor, and I appreciate it to no end.
Happy to be here. Yep.
Well, let's start with the interesting title of your book. How did you decide on the meanest man in Congress?
It wasn't original to us. It was what Jack Brooks' colleagues in Congress called him. And they meant it, and he took it as a compliment, because he was a tough, tough questioner. He didn't take guff from administration department heads, Democrat or Republican. He didn't take anything guff from Pentagon generals or from corporate CEOs. When his job as chairman of the Oversight Committee, and then later to the Judiciary Committee, he would question people without fear or favor.
Well, and let me say, while he may have been tough to all those very important people, he was also very tough on very young, naive campaign aides. I met Congressman Brooks exactly once when I was finance director for Nick Glamson, who became a congressman in that seat. We had Harry Truman's train bought down for a big event. It was raining. I had my staff gathered to meet the illustrious Congressman Jack Brooks. He and his lovely wife and a friend walked up to me, and he started screaming curse words at me and was furious about the placements of the signs that we had put out for the event. I didn't introduce him to my staff. We just went and moved the signs.
So you think he's the meanest man in Congress?
I thought the title was perfect.
What's funny is we've actually run into people since the book has come out, whether through Amazon reviews or just comments to excerpts online, and everyone seems to have their own Jack Brooks story and how he tore them a new one, or in one way or another.
Well, I think that was his natural way of speaking, because his wife was so charming and just stood there smiling beautifully the whole time he was just screaming these expletives at us, and then they went inside and got a cocktail,
Yes.
And everything was just fine.
Charlotte Brooks was beatific, and he would, well, he was also known, and to people who were before his committees, they would often mutter that SOB, and Brooks told his staff to say, well, just think about it. They're saying that sweet old Brooks.
Well, and this may lead into your first story, but I'm curious as to how you decided to devote several years of your life to Congressman Brooks.
He is one of the quietest legislators who had the most influence, who people have never heard about. And it was a question of whether he was influencing the airline safety or the inspector generals in each federal department, or writing the articles of impeachment for Richard Nixon. He was so influential, and yet he never sought publicity outside of Beaumont and his district, which often increased depending on the gerrymandering and redistricting in parts of Houston. But he had accomplished so much, and he didn't care about having a national reputation. He would just like to make sure that he kept power and influence in Washington, and then was reelected every time in Beaumont.
I've just recently started admitting to myself and to others in public that my mom badgered me into it. my father had picked up this project, and he was working on it, and I was doing my own thing at the World Bank, and she kept saying, your father, he could use your help, because I was a writer. I'd spent years in media as well, and I was kind of like open to other projects, but not really considering this. I wasn't I didn't quite see the light yet. And, you know, every conversation that I had with her on the phone was like, okay, love you, goodbye. Yeah, and you should help your father. Yeah,
well,
be good.
And Brendan is admittedly a much better writer and a much, much better researcher.
I guess that's why you're a good team. You know, you touched on the fact that most Americans don't know Jack Brooks' name and can't tell you anything about him. However, I think every single American has seen his face probably hundreds of times in that photograph of Lyndon Johnson being sworn in on Air Force One after President Kennedy's. And I was wondering if you could tell us a story about that whole day.
He's on that iconic photograph of Lyndon Johnson putting his hand on the Bible, and Jackie Kennedy in the bloodstained suit she was wearing behind him, and Brooks is right over her left shoulder. Brooks had been with Kennedy and Johnson and the others in the motorcade in Dallas, and then after the shooting, he had gone with the Secret Service to Parkland Hospital. And there he stayed mostly with Johnson and with Lady Bird. And Johnson would not leave the hospital until doctors confirmed that the president was dead. And then, only then, he said, okay, let's go. And the Secret Service organized a very quick two-car caravan, maybe three with a chase car, but Lyndon Johnson went in one. He asked Jack Brooks to go with Lady Bird in the other car, and they sped to Love Field in Dallas, and there got on the plane. And again, Johnson, they kept encouraging him to fly Air Force One to Washington right away, and he said, no, I'm not going until the First Lady is here with the president's body. And so that's what they waited there. And finally, when Mrs. Kennedy came up and they administered the oath of office, and Johnson said, okay, we can fly off now. At the same time, underneath all this was going on, is that there were a lot of people saying, we have to go back to Washington right away.
All the Secret Service agents were in favor of getting the plane in the air as soon as possible.
And the Air Force as well. And so, but Brooks and I think it was Thornberry, another congressman, they advised Johnson. They said, let's administer the office here and now. Don't wait to go to Washington. Frankly, because one thing, Brooks didn't trust the president's brother, Robert Kennedy, who was the attorney general. He suspected that Kennedy would find some way to delay the administering the office or something else. And so they kept saying to Johnson, wait, let's do it here and then go on to Washington. In reality, Johnson was the president. It didn't matter about the administration of the oath of office. But at the same time, symbolically, it was important. And that's as his friend and advisor, Brooks told Johnson, do it now.
Do you know how long they were on the tarmac for?
About 90 minutes.
That's what I thought. And I think I recalled that the AC wasn't on.
The AC wasn't on. Mm-hmm. It was loud. People were hungry because nobody had eaten. They were supposed to be eating at the park. I forget whatever the next event was going to be, but Johnson ended up scarfing down a vegetable soup. Somebody had shuttled some of that on the plane, and people were eating that. But
and it was such a traumatic time. You can imagine the people who were Kennedy's staff were there with the people who were Johnson's staff, and they didn't really have a lot of love for each other. So you had to navigate all this momentous change this country hadn't seen for a long, long time. And anyway, Brooks was there. He went with Johnson afterwards when they arrived back in Washington. He went up with the Johnsons to the vice presidential house they lived in and stayed and was with him basically for the next week every day.
And the real joy of researching this story in particular was, you know, so much has been written about that day. That's probably the most reported on day in human history, you know, possibly. But nobody had really looked at, okay, who was advising Johnson in Parkland Hospital, on sitting there on the tarmac? Why did he make the decisions he made? And this, looking at the three Texas congressmen that were there at his side, at the hospital in Air Force One, I mean, that was kind of a wholly new part of history that we were able to look at for the first time. You know, most of them did not speak to the Warren Commission. You know, they weren't interviewed by Robert Caro when he did his, you know, monumental work on LBJ. So this was really kind of, you know, newfound territory.
Well, I have to agree, because I'm completely obsessed with that day. I've met many, many witnesses. I've read everything I could, and I've never heard this, you know. So I thank you, you know, for unearthing this story and sharing it with us.
One thing with the Brooks and Robert Caro book, Brooks didn't like Caro's first book on LBJ, and so he refused to talk to him.
Mm.
And that was just the way it was. He wasn't seeking any more publicity, and he didn't like something. He was very forthright about it.
Hey, Hank, are you out there? I guess, Hank.
No, I am out here. I am trying to do a professional juggling routine, trying to get to the phone, which I don't really know how to use because none of us do. This is a little bit too high-tech for all of us. A little bit too high-tech.
Well, we can come back to you if you'd like.
No. Don't you dare.
Now, friends, if you want to speak to the one and only Dr. Hank Rubicek, now is your chance. You don't know how sought after this opportunity is.
Yeah, and if you want to come out to 419 Lovett, I'll even come and tell you a story.
He will do that.
We need you out here, yeah. You know, this is actually an interesting theme, and it is so closely aligned, Greg, to the station. KPFT began after World War II during the peace movement, when freedom of expression without corporate sponsorship was really a new notion, but it worked out. And in a world where freedom of expression is in question, I think that this station is more important than ever, and that's why we need everybody's support. You know, the Klan tried to shut us up by bombing us. So in existence, our existence is beyond essential. So we really do need our community to give us a call at 713-526-5738, JAM KPFT, or please go to www.kpft.org if you're not a phone person. And once you do that, go to donation, select a form of payment, and scroll. This is important. Just so what's your story as the show that you wish to support. You know, So What's Your Story is truly an icon to community radio. We have guests like the terrific individuals we had this evening. We have had over 620, in last count, guests since 2008, which is sort of an intriguing story
that
itself.
That is amazing. You know, That's absolutely amazing.
Well, in 2008, Ernesto Aguilar, great guy, he was our program manager at the time. I was a guest on a Open Journal, which is what the title would suggest. It's an open forum. It's an open program. You don't really know what you're getting. So I was a guest on an Open Journal, and it was a good show. And I was talking about the power of storytelling and the power of human narrative. It was sort of a short academic piece. That week, I get a call from Ernesto, who says, Hank, you know, you did a really good job. And at first I said, who is this again? You know, I didn't remember. He said, you did a great job, and the person who did the show quit. And I said, I hope it wasn't me. But she had to quit. She had to move to Michigan.
What did you do to her, Hank?
And asked me if I wanted to do the show. And I said, well, okay, I'm game. I love radio. I'm in communication. This sounds great. He asked me if I had an idea of what kind of a program I wanted to do. And I said to him, well, you know, programs like An American Life work very well. And that was the big show at the time. And I said, something that models that I think would work fantastically, because this is a city that can showcase its citizens, its neighbors, its experts in so many different areas by giving them a chance to tell personal stories. And he said, that's a great idea. I don't think anybody's going to listen, but go ahead and give it a shot. And I did. And after 2 years, we went weekly. It was at 6 a.m. on Monday morning. And as ungodly as that sounds, it actually worked. And then we moved to Wednesday, moved to Thursday, then back to Wednesday, and then now we have a really coveted spot. We are hovered between Wally James and the Progressive Forum, which frankly is an institution at this station.
Amen.
And Lars Tennyson tape deck, which follows up. And we like it when he's gone sometimes because we get to play disc jockey.
That's a lot of fun. We love Lars, but it is fun playing disc jockey.
Not as good as Lars, so we want him to be here. But the point is, we have a show that we believe really is an icon of community radio. And when we're hovered between those two excellent programs that I just articulated, this is a great spot on Thursday nights. We've got great programs. We've got DJs dropping the needle on tunes that you're only going to hear right here on KPFT. So I'm babbling, but there's a reason, because we need our community to know that this is listener-sponsored. You, everyone out there, Houstonians, you're the ones who make the station your station. And if you love live storytelling, and how can you not? We need you to give us a call and let us know that you want us to stay alive at 713-526-5738. Jam KPFT. A little bit later on, we want to find out from Tatiana what her really special experiences has been here. Tatiana, you can chime in, please. You've been an intern for a while, but now you're no longer an intern. You're an integral part of the team, not that you weren't.
Absolutely.
And you have really experienced a lot over the years, and I want you to think about some of your favorite stories, and maybe Greg and I will see what you think in just a few minutes.
And you know what else I was thinking, Hank, just the other day? Do you realize that our guests on this program have ranged in age from 11 years old to 100 years old?
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and the 100 years old is around my age, but nevertheless, yes. Yeah.
That was Dr. Thomas Freeman from Texas Southern University.
Yeah, we really have. We have had a tremendous range. We've had everybody from people talking about, there was one woman who was on years ago, one of my earlier shows, who disclosed for the very first time her daughter's murder in Detroit. I didn't even know what she was going to talk about. She said she has a coming out story. She has a story that she wants to share. This is a writer. And my jaw was just open for an hour. I couldn't believe the story that she was sharing. We've had people like that. We've had incredible stories about comedy, tragedy, every kind of emotional trajectory known to humankind. And you gentlemen tonight are doing a great job talking about Brooks and talking about stories that surround a very, very unique character. And I don't want to take any more time. I want to get back to the stories tonight.
All right. Well, thanks, Hank. We will be checking back with you. And friends, call Hank, 713-526-5738. Now, gentlemen, got some more questions for you. Tim, it seems like your career basically has been as a storyteller in a wide variety of media. When did you realize you were a storyteller?
I'm not sure if there was a time that I recognized that how much I loved doing that. Although I do take to heart what the Irish call a writer. And they call a writer a failed talker. and so that's what I think, that melding from talking to writing and then back again has defined me. If I can take a moment, I wanted to talk about a little bit about the biography of Jack Brooks, because he is of the greatest generation that Tom Brokaw wrote about. And I think that that's something that is worth exploring. He is very Texan, obviously. His in Congress, he was with these other giant Texans like Sam Rayburn, LBJ, Jim Wright, Dolph Briscoe he called him his, quote, bosom buddy, end quote. And what he learned in the war, he was a Marine in World War II and island hopping in the Pacific. And what he learned was the power of kind of negotiating and understanding what someone else needs, what and how that fits with what you want. And that really translated into his role in Congress, first in the Texas legislature for two terms, but then in Congress. And he went from the Eisenhower administration to Clinton. And so all that time, he was developing, he was learning from Rayburn and others and LBJ how to deal, and that's where he was kind of he was masterful at using the system. For instance, when he was, there was a vote when the Congress was ready to take the funds away from the NASA's space station, and of course NASA was in his district at that time, and the vote was going to go against NASA. It had just, they had just voted to defund money for the super collider, which went to Switzerland, and it was a time when they were ready to cut back on money. He wanted the NASA to continue the space station, and he, by understanding the rules and of Congress, he figured out that if he could get, and he campaigned and lobbied for people to vote his way, and there came time to delay it, and he delayed it until the last time he couldn't delay it anymore, and the vote was so close that he said, all right, we'll have to do it now. And at that moment, John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia, walked in and cast the deciding vote to keep NASA's space station. And it was what they, we talked to the former head of NASA, and he said it was all because of Brooks. Otherwise, it would be gone.
Wow. As a child whose father worked at NASA and worked on the space station, I'm very appreciative that he did that.
And that wasn't the only time that he saved NASA. In the Reagan administration, when they were trying to tighten up the federal budget, they had this great project that had gone out to try to kind of more and create efficiencies within the federal government. And they thought, oh, well, you know, there's the Goddard Space Station in Maryland. And they said, well, you know, there's no real point to have one in Maryland and one in Texas, so why don't we, you know, combine you know, our energy and bring the manned space station back to the D.C. area. And Jack Brooks heard about this, and he made a phone call. And he made a phone call to Jim Wright, you know, who was then not quite a speaker, but definitely high up in the leadership. And he said, this is what they're trying to do to save a few bucks. This is going to be terrible to the Gulf area. And then Jim Wright made a few calls, and within hours, that plan had been squashed.
Wow. Well, you know, I got to tell you, I love Jim Wright. He was, when I was a student writing newspaper columns, he was incredibly kind to me for no reason. I was a dumb, broke 21-year-old kid that had nothing to offer the Speaker of the House of the United States of America. Yeah. But he spent an hour with me, just showing me around the office, showing me his view, and what a class act.
He's a very gracious man. He wrote the introduction to our book, and I interviewed him. He's such an elegant man, an elegant speaker, too.
Class act.
You know, yeah, yeah.
In fact, you have a story, I believe, that touches on the relationship between Speaker Wright and Chairman Brooks.
And Newt Gingrich, who kind of came to his public relations power by condemning and assassinating others' character, he had gone after Wright as Speaker. And
Jack Brooks and Jim Wright, they'd known each other since the 50s.
Right, that's true.
I mean,
true.
They both fought in World War II. They served in the Texas legislature together. Jim Wright had this funny comment that he would tell people that he was born, I think, the day after Jack Brooks, and then he'd been trying to catch up with him ever since. He entered the Texas legislature two years later. He entered the U.S. legislature 2 years later.
Oh, that's great.
And he was just kind of continually, even though he rose to leadership, he was just always kind of grasping after what Jack had already achieved.
Yeah.
So they'd known each other for decades at that point by the time Newt came into the play.
And I'm sorry, what were you about the question?
I think you were talking about when Newt Gingrich was attacking Jim Wright.
Yeah, so Wright decided to end all these personal attacks. It was not only affecting him, I think it was affecting his wife a great deal, and he just decided to end it, and so he resigned in a kind of remarkable public announcement on the floor of the House. And Brooks was the first one up afterwards, just tearing into Gingrich because he had defamed an honorable man. And at that time, he was Wright's greatest defender. And Brooks was a loyal person. He was, despite the other things that would happen in Congress, when he was a friend to someone, when he made a commitment, he stuck by it. Even avoiding voting for Wright when he was Speaker because he had already promised his vote to someone else. And I asked Wright about that, and he said he respected that because if you pledge your vote to someone else, then you got to keep that. And then, of course, the person that he did vote for, the congressman from California, and then he didn't win, and then he switched and voted for Wright as Speaker.
Wow, that's amazing to me. I mean, I just don't think of politicians these days having much honor between each other.
Well, you know, when Brooks was with, they were negotiating between the House and the Senate, one bill versus another bill, and they each needed the other's support. And so in a meeting with the House leadership and Brooks, with Bob Dole and the Senate leadership, they worked out an agreement about who would vote for what, which was the kind of horse trading that Congress was always known for. And so when the negotiating was finished, Dole said, well, I want that in writing from each of you. And the leadership said, and Brooks too. And Dole said, nah, Brooks's word is good.
Wow.
And then, of course, later Brooks called him up and said, God, or damn it. It's like, you can't compliment me in front of my own leadership.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, it was the kind of a life in Congress in that generation that was so different from the way it is now. This personal destruction, this enemy of the people, not just on the of the media, but of the other party. It's just a very different way of working. Brooks understood that the way that Congress worked was compromise, and the way it is now, it doesn't seem to be any compromise.
Well, he had learned all that from Rayburn, and Rayburn's one of his famous maxims. He was known for these: was to get along, you have to go along. So you have to know who your allies are. You have to know who your rivals are, your enemies, and you know, you have to break bread with them. You know, you have to actually live in D.C. A lot of times, congressmen now, they don't live in D.C. anymore. They don't move their families there. You know, they live in kind of congressional dorm rooms, so they can, you know, be there for a few votes and then go back to the district, fundraise, you know, and continue on with their lives. So the paradigm's totally changed. And, you know,
it's a lot easier to trash someone when you're not sitting across the table eating with them and your kids don't know each other.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's it. And they had lived in the same neighborhoods. The kids went to the same schools. And the spouses, they had their clubs they went to. Usually the spouses were women, of course, in that time.
Yeah, there's an investment, a personal investment.
Yeah, so for instance, when the Brookses lived in Washington, down the street, Strom Thurmond, the old segregationist, and he was down there, and he became famous for a number of things. But one of them was marrying a woman who was 45 years his junior. And so one day Brooks and Strom Thurmond were on their sidewalks and they're walking toward each other, and Thurmond, you know, looked up and saw Brooks and happily announced that we're having a baby. And Brooks looked back at him and kind of didn't say anything for a moment, and then looked balefully and said, who do you suspect?
So they were able to rib with each other. They had a relationship.
Yeah. Wow. And you know, let me add just a little caveat. One of the finest books I've ever read was the autobiography of Strom Thurmond's African American daughter, Essie Mae Washington Williams. One of the most fascinating, powerful books about how the staunch segregationist had a secret African American daughter that he had a relationship with through her life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating. I encourage everyone to read it. Now, Brendan, I'm guessing that you grew up in a home where you heard a story or two on occasion.
A few.
But when did you realize you were a storyteller?
You know, it's embarrassing, but it was probably about halfway through the book.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I'd been a journalist before, but it was hard news, so it was really just kind of, we call them nine-liners, because you only had to get nine lines in order to publish a story, and it was like who, what, where, when, and why. And maybe even one of those would be missing if it was, you know, this was hard-paced news that we were doing at the time in Chicago. And, you know, and then I turned to consulting, and I was doing much longer kind of developmental stories where, you know, I was writing for journals and kind of telling a development story, which was much more based on economics and poverty and kind of equity. And then I started working on this story, and I just, you know, I mean, it was interesting, and I loved telling it, but then it was while researching the impeachment hearings in 1974, and I was digging through the congressman's books, all of his papers he donated to the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas in Austin, and, you know, it's 860-some square feet of papers there, and they can't even keep them on site because there's so many boxes of papers. So I was just kind of looking through the manifest and then calling whatever came to my attention, and I saw some. I'd heard that he'd written the articles of impeachment against Nixon, so I was trying to locate those papers, you know, maybe find some smoking gun of, you know, the actual notes that he took. And it was during the course of just looking through these old memos, calendars, you know, notes that he'd written to the leadership then, that he'd written to Chairman Rodino saying, you know, no, like, we subpoenaed these documents 2 months ago and there's been no action, you know, do it again. And there's actually a picture in the book of him writing a memo to the chairman saying, you know, you have to act on this. Mm. You have to act on this. It's your congressional duty. It's our congressional duty. And it just kind of became clear to me, you know, I'd never known about this. I don't think anybody I'd spoken to really knew about the, you know, the actual way that Nixon's resignation came about, you know? I mean, they say journalism is, or the news is kind of the first draft of history, but history gets, as we remember it, it gets changed so many different ways depending on what happens and really who's writing the history books. I mean, you see with what's happened with, you know, even politicians in our lifetime. I mean, Reagan is now this just political lion who did no wrong and who made no mistakes and, you know, single-handedly crushed the, you know, the evil empire. And you look back at the facts and you're thinking, well, not exactly. You know, that somehow happened. You know, Ted Cruz for some reason has a bust of, you know, a life-size bust of Ted Cruz, of Reagan in his office. But I don't know, how did that happen? And it just comes from people, you know, telling the story. And I wanted to do it accurately. So I was reading these papers that all concern the impeachment hearings. And in particular, there was one that he had issued a letter that he'd written to, actually, he wasn't quite Vice President Ford at the time. It was during the confirmation hearings for Ford months prior to the impeachment hearings, because Ford was a minority leader at the time. And Jack Brooks had the foresight to know that, okay, if he's confirmed for Vice President, he's then going to be in a position where he may become president and he may have some, you know, vote kind of splitting, vote in the Senate. So he understood that he had to put basically the, you know, the pins to Ford right then. So he wrote out a list of 50 some questions, you know, is it unlawful if the president lies about his taxes, if he lies to the American public, if he lies to Congress? And he detailed, you know, in several pages, just exactly where he stood on all of these questions, which he understood might come up and solve a constitutional crisis in the coming months. And I was just looking at this piece of paper, which probably hadn't been, you know, touched by human hands in 50 years, and thinking, my God, you know, we're actually doing something with this book. You know, this is actually adding to the historical record.
Well, I'm obsessed with this time period. I've never heard this. You know, this is fantastic.
Well, it's in the book.
All right. Well, this is Greg Audell with my guest, the McNultys, and Tatiana Gago in our control room with Dr. Hank at Pledge Central. And you are listening to stories about the late chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, Jack Brooks, who served 42 years in Congress, from Beaumont, Texas, with guest storytellers Tim and Brendan McNulty on 90.1 KPFT, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Tatiana, are you over there?
Yes, I am.
How about filling our friends in on the happenings in the phenomenal Houston storytelling community in the next few weeks?
It would be my pleasure, Greg. The growth of the Houston storytelling scene just continues to expand. And so What's Your Story has been a major part of that by being one of the first weekly storytelling venues in Houston. And let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset, directly across from Rice University. And it's a great place to listen, tell, and discuss stories with a supportive group of like-minded people. The next swap is October 22nd, and for more information about the Guild's events, go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, why not become a member online? And don't leave their webpage before clicking on radio program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of shows since 2008. So What's Your Story was the first storytelling scene in Houston, and it is the seed to help grow our storytelling community. So please enjoy a garden of our past programs and continue to tune in every week for live stories that connect us to each other. And if you don't have a radio, that's no problem, because you can catch us online anywhere on the globe at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And if you have program ideas, questions about storytelling, suggestions for guest tellers, or tell us why you'd be a great guest, drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. And if you want to take your storytelling interest to the next level, the Tejas Storytelling Association and National Storytelling Network are waiting for you to become a member. You can check them out online. And our friends at the Moss hold their monthly story swap on the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. The next one is October 8th, and the theme is spooky. It's a great place to listen to wonderful stories. Got anything else to say, Greg?
No, I'm sorry. Sorry about that, Tatiana. You know, I really do encourage you. You know, if you enjoy listening to a good story, the only thing better than listening to a great story is telling a great story. And I hope you'll take advantage of one of these many opportunities throughout the Houston area. You know, listen to some tellers and then maybe try your own story. And I always suggest people start with the story they've told the friends 100 times, you know, so they don't have to think about it. You know, you can just tell the story that's in your heart that you know people are going to be interested in.
Can I follow up on that right
Absolutely.
Now? Absolutely. I'll tell you the story. I spent my career as a journalist, both domestically and overseas, and as, later as an editor. But daily journalism is a far different thing than writing a book. And this is the first time I've written a book. And what I discovered was a real joy in being able to spend the time and to do the research and to discover things that daily journalism just doesn't allow for. Perhaps you could if you're, you know, you could have 6 months, you could have different stories depending on what they were, how important they were. But still, the idea of going to a book and really digging into it and finding a biography of a man, that is something that's complex. And that's, I found, extraordinarily rewarding. For example, the one thing that I wanted to make sure I understood for a chapter was about Brooks's time in during World War II as a Marine in the South Pacific in the island hopping. He couldn't remember a lot of the details when I was interviewing in his later life. And so I asked his family to go and request his military records from the main office in St. Louis. They've sent down for it, and months later, we got a package of papers, and it was literally 3 feet high of individual pieces of paper about his life as a Marine, not only during the war, but he was in the Marine Corps Reserve until he was 65 and retired from there. it was the most dull, dreary kind of bureaucratic pieces of paper, hundreds and hundreds of them. And I felt the duty to go through them just because, I might find something, but the family had requested it. I felt an obligation. And so I went down and toward the very bottom of the pile, these two or three boxes of books, there were five pages that detailed what island he was on during what fighting period, what ship, troop ship, that he moved from one island to another, when he was in Japan, or when he was getting ready to go into Japan, and when he went to China. Those five pages were the most detailed, as only the military does, and they were just exciting and rewarding, and they formed the entire basis of the chapter. So when you talk about storytelling, it's that sudden realization that I've learned something that everyone else had either forgotten or never known. That was my joy.
And there was another gem with that chapter. Once we were actually finished with the manuscript, the first draft, the Brooks family was gracious enough to let us go to the congressman's house that he had bought for his mother 100 years, well, quite, maybe 100 years earlier, and maybe 80 years earlier. But we're up in the attic, and we're going through all this paraphernalia from his first congressional races, and we see this big just hunk of a chest in the corner, and it has USMC stenciled on it, U.S. Marine Corps. And this thing is covered in dust. Looks like it hasn't been opened probably since the World War. And we convinced the congressman's daughter to let us open it up, go through. And he was a communications specialist. So we open it up, and it's all these old, Chinese and Japanese and American radio parts. All these spare parts and, parts of his uniform and different knickknacks that he'd brought back from the South Pacific. And then in two different folders, there are about 300 letters. Old, yellowing, just written out, typed letters. Every single one that he had sent home and ordered his sister to save, and everyone that he had received from the U.S. and then sent home to his sister and ordered her to save.
Wow.
So from basic training in April 1943 to right before he was about to be sent into Japan August 45, we have every letter that he sent and received during the war.
That's incredible.
And it is, and going through that, especially after the book was done, we thought we were finished. And then we find this trove, and we're like, we have to go back. We have to read we have to incorporate this. So that was another real joy.
Were you happy or exhausted at that point, or both?
Exhausted and just fascinated.
Yeah.
I mean, because he was such a sharp mind, and the people that he corresponded with, they went on to do great things. One in particular, her name was Annie Corrick. And I don't know, he was a ladies' man, back when he was a bachelor. And so I could never tell, he corresponded with different women and men, and, I could never tell who was a girlfriend and who was an ex-girlfriend, maybe. But they had kind of a special relationship, and I could tell because he would write, his sister the way that he felt about it, and she definitely wanted to date him, but he said that, it just wasn't, he wasn't feeling it. But they still corresponded for years, and her letters were just like poetry. I mean, she was just such a brilliant mind, and I loved reading her letters, and she would draw little images up in the margins about, exotic birds that she imagined must have been on the island of Guam where he was. And she actually, after she worked as a journalist for the student newspaper at UT with him, and she was offered a job with a wire service at covering the White House during the war. So she had these amazing stories of going to events at the White House and petting Roosevelt's dog and all these things. And after the book was finished and came out, I was curious. I was like, whatever happened to her? Because I remembered her name, but I hadn't heard about anything since. She ended up becoming the president of the National Broadcasting Association, the NBU. And further, she actually dated Kennedy before Kennedy got married. So, I mean, I think if...
Sounds like that might be your next book.
If there's... I might be... I might be looking
didn't
for
didn't everybody
other
Dave Kennedy?
Wow, that is amazing.
Yeah, well, didn't everybody?
I was trying not to say that. Well, Hank, what's going on in Pledge Central?
Well, right now, unfortunately, we're a little quiet, and it's not a good feeling. It's a little frustrating and a little disappointing.
Friends, you don't want Hank to be lonely. This is your only chance to talk to the one and only Hank Rubicek.
Forget about being lonely. What if you tuned in and you heard... That's right, silence. What if you did that? That would be terrible, right? And that's why we want people to call in. 713-526-5738. You know, none of us get paid doing this. Everybody knows that. But you don't listen in and say, well, you know what, it's a terrible show, but what do you expect from a bunch of guys who don't get paid? You expect excellence, and we like to think that we give it to you. All of our shows do. So we need you to give us a call and let us know that the hard work that we do is worth it. That when you turn the dial every day, every night, on Thursday nights, this is What's Your Story, that you listen to something that enhances your life. But we need you to keep us alive, folks. 713-526-5738. We need you to give us a call or get online to www.kpft.org, then to donations, tell us how you want to pay, and then please scroll to So What's Your Story is one of the shows that you want to support. Tatiana, you've been here a long time. Tell us about some of the stories that made a real indelible impression on you.
You know, I have been here for exactly 2 years, 1 month, and 17
Woo-hoo!
Days. And I have heard hundreds and hundreds of stories. So many, mostly from Nadia Hakim. I always have like a favorite story from her. Her most recent one was when she was about to be left from getting on her cruise. I forgot where she was, but she just had like an amazing adventure with her partner. We've had Lola Corazon. Like, that was... It was a sad story about her divorce, about getting a divorce, but she also added in some humor into it. There have been like other students on here have been Jason Rivas, when I hosted him over a year ago, like back in August. Stories about how he went through some obstacles and then went from being a high school dropout to a teacher assistant at Texas State University. Texas State University. And, you know, one of the best stories, actually, from this show is the sad stories for me, because when I'm in here, like when I'm in the studio, I get to see the genuine and raw emotions that happen in here. So also, like, what I've noticed is that I learn a little bit about people based on the stories that they tell. And also, one of the biggest lies I hear is, like, when I tell people what I do, being on here weekly, they always tell me, I don't have a story. And to me, that is one of the biggest lies ever, because I somehow get a story from someone that same day.
It's amazing, isn't it? It really is. That's well, very, very well put.
And Tatiana, you're an important really part of this program, and we do value you. When I know the control room is under control, I don't have to think about it.
Boy, isn't that
the truth?
And
I'm allowed to focus on the guest. And if I didn't have confidence in you, it would be very hard for me to do what I do in here.
Yeah.
So please know you're appreciated.
Hear, hear. Very well said. You know, you talk about the sad stories, Tatiana. That was very well put. You know, these sad stories, the difficult stories, I should say, mm-hmm. are the ones that really require the tellers give themselves permission, that they trust themselves, that they have to dig deep and talk about something that's raw and real and something that has no filter. And when you put that together with a beginning and a middle and an end with a tight episode, and you get people to become engaged, it really doesn't get a whole lot deeper and better than that. So I appreciate you saying
that's
that.
That's one of the things Amen. I love yeah. about being here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the chance, Greg. But absolutely. We're still waiting for some calls. But you know what? Our friend Lars is out here, and thank goodness he is, because he's on the phone with somebody as we speak, and maybe we have someone to thank.
All right. Well, friends,
we
please
he's
give
nodding,
us a call.
He's nodding yes. So come back to me in about 90 seconds or so, and we're going to have somebody to thank. Thanks,
Greg. And if you want to have another person, if you want to be thanked or help us out, you can call 713-526-5738. Now, next week, we're going to have a host you haven't heard from in a while, Dr. Hank Rubicek. He will usher in his favorite season of Halloween with haunting stories from great tellers, including a couple of newbies, and, of course, It was not Halloween without Hank's famous noisemakers, which I'm sure he's winding up and getting ready right now.
Yeah, good I am. Thanks to Mary. Mary, thank you, Mary.
And our fall fun drive does continue for a few more weeks, and it's all right here on So What's Your Story each and every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Now, Brendan, we talked a little bit earlier before we were on air about summer vacations. I don't know about you folks. Most of my summer vacations were riding my bike around my neighborhood, maybe going to a hot, sweaty camp in the middle of Texas. How about you, Brendan? What were your summer vacations like?
Well, one of the great benefits of being the son of a White House correspondent was what used to be the case was presidents would bring, they would clear out Air Force Two, and when they went on vacation, they loaded up Air Force Two with all of the press corps and their families, and they would bring them wherever they were going. So with Ronald Reagan, we went to Santa Barbara. With George Herbert Walker Bush, we went to Kennebunkport, Maine. So this is where we would spend our Christmas, Thanksgivings. This is where we would spend some of our summers. And I don't know if you remember that as well as I do. It's crystal clear in my head.
Did you both appreciate at the time you being able to bring your family, and did you realize how out of this world it was?
No, not really. I thought everyone did this, and I did not appreciate it at the time.
Well, that was one of the. There are a few perks with covering the White House. I thought I had been a foreign correspondent before. And I thought covering the White House, I was either too old or too young because I felt it was more of a stenographer's job. But there were perks like going off to Kennebunkport for several weeks and going to Santa Barbara. And being able to bring family, because an awful lot of the time I was gone without family. And that is something that, you know, you pay a price. For that, but I think the whether being overseas or going with the White House, the idea of sharing these stories and these times was just great. Barbara Bush was, you know, she didn't like the press at all. George H.W. Bush was much, even though he liked photographers more than reporters, but he was much more gracious than Barbara was. But for children, Barbara Bush was tremendous. I know, actually, Bush signed a baseball cap for Brendan, and then Barbara Bush looked at it, and he had used a faint magic marker, and she said, "Oh, that won't do," and so took Brendan into the house and with a new magic marker and came back out and said, "George, now sign this with this one." And
nice. So he got sounds a, like Barbara Bush.
Yeah. And not only that, I was wearing a Chicago Cubs hat, so he signed that, and then he was actually wearing a hat too. So Barbara said, "Well, give him your hat as well." So he took off his hat, wrote his name on it, and gave me that.
Oh, wow. I'm surprised they would have signed a Chicago Cubs hat.
That's well, what we had.
And then there are other times, like with, you know, parties at the White House, if there was some time that my wife and I would go. But then once my wife said, "Well, this probably be the last one since we're giving up the White House beat." And so she asked to take our other son, and I took him there, which was fine. He was dressed smartly. He was early teens. And then I looked over one time in the East Room, and people were circulating, and he had decided that all the chocolates looked pretty good on the buffet table, and so he started putting the chocolates in his pockets, and I could see over at the Secret Service looking at him, and I thought, oh my, but anyway, he was fine.
He did something else pretty notable back then. He might have taken one of the first selfies. This is late 80s. Right. He had one of those disposable Kodak cameras, and he held it out and took a picture with him and Herbert Walker.
Oh, that is awesome. Not many parents get to supply these experiences. Well, I want to thank Tim and Brendan McNulty for sharing these fascinating stories of a complicated man, and I cannot wait to read The Meanest Man in Congress. Well, friends, you stay put, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson Tape Deck. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us each and every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is absolutely never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.